What are you looking for?
I have to leave in 2 minutes. I gotta go across the
street.
This meeting of the Senate Environment and Energy Committee will come to order. First bill we, and there is a quorum present. The first bill we have on the agenda is Senate File 113. Senator Sparks, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's nice to return back to the Environment and Energy Committee, which I served on my previous 10 years, but I can see that this committee is in good shape. Today, Mr. Chair and members, we'd like to present to you Senate File 113. I think in your packets you should have a handout. This is the Drainage Work Group, and this is the third time that we've been back with these consensus recommendations. The first time we passed legislation in this regard was in 2007, again in 2010, and we're back in front of you today. I think that you can see that we have a broad-based coalition that's done a lot of the heavy working to bring forward these recommendations. Many times these drainage issues can get contentious, but I think if you see the list of members that are on there, I'm not going to read them all for you, but we do have drainage authorities, farm groups, environmental groups, other associations and universities, state agencies, and the legislature. And in fact, Mr. Chairman, there are many members of the work group in the audience today. I know that you have a long agenda, Mr. Chairman. This bill did pass out of the Ag Committee, but we're glad to bring it in front of you today. And with that, I would like to turn it over to Al Kane from the Board of Soil and Water Resources to walk you through the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Al Kane. I serve as the Chief Engineer for the Board of Water and Soil Resources and also serve as the facilitator for the Stakeholder Drainage Work Group. In the bill before you, there are four primary recommendations. One of those is to add a subdivision that would enable the reestablishment of drainage system records where they are lost, destroyed, or otherwise incomplete. Drainage authorities have done this sort of work in the past, but it hasn't been a clear definition within drainage law of how to do that reestablishment of drainage system records. So the Drainage Work Group is recommending a process that includes some due process in terms of notification of landowners, also notification of the DNR and the Board of Water and Soil Resources for drainage records reestablishment. And this was one recommendation that also was contained in the Smith Partners report that was done through an LCCMR grant that was titled Drainage Law Evaluation and Analysis. So the Drainage Work Group has been reviewing and discussing many of the recommendations in that report. This is one that we are recommending clarification of drainage law for records reestablishment. The second piece, main part of this recommendations before you, is to clarify the transfer of drainage system records. Drainage authorities include watershed districts and counties. There also is the potential for WMOs within the metro area, watershed management organizations. And there isn't a clear definition of the transfer of records when a drainage system is transferred, particularly between a county and a watershed district. And oftentimes that occurs in part because if there's an improvement or an establishment, those automatically under 103D go to a watershed district if there is one in that area. And the records then, there may be a need for both the county and the watershed district to have a copy of those records because the entire system may not be transferred. And this provision enables an authenticated copy of the records when a watershed district or a county and a county both have a need for those drainage system records. There's also a provision here, another of the primary purposes is to clarify authority for wetland and water quality improvement elements in projects that are implemented under Section 103E227, which is impoundment, rerouting, and diversion of drainage system waters, and under Section 103E701, which is repairs on Chapter 103E drainage systems. So this is not a new authority. It's a clarification of authority within those sections that also refer back to a provision that was added to drainage law in 2000 that enables drainage systems to accept external sources of funding for specific purposes, including water quality, erosion control, flood control purposes. So again, that's a clarification. And the fourth primary portion of this law is to enable a multi-stage drainage ditch cross-section when a repair is done where that might be the most stable and effective cross-section. But under current drainage law, it requires the drainage authority to return that ditch cross-section to its original condition or its previously improved condition. And therefore, that's typically a trapezoidal cross-section with a certain grade, if you will, and dimensions. This provision would enable drainage authorities for a petitioned repair, if it was the reasonable thing to do, to use a two-stage ditch, for example. You may have heard about two-stage ditches, which is really a low-flow channel within a cross-section that's a trapezoidal channel, so a two-stage ditch. And think about where there's perennial low flow in a stream or a ditch, and typically a low flow meandering small channel will develop within that cross-section. This provision would enable a drainage authority and a drainage system to adopt that kind of cross-section with the same hydraulic capacity as the original drainage ditch was designed for. So those are the primary provisions of this law. There are also then some definitions that go along with that, some updates of definitions, the update of the definition of a board, which includes a county board, a watershed district board, or a metro watershed management organization board who do have drainage authority under Chapter 103E. And we've updated the definition of director, which is the director of what was the Division of Waters within DNR and is now the Division of Ecological and Water Resources. So that definition is also being updated in this bill. And there's a definition of secretary, which is the secretary of watershed district, who serves many of the same functions as an auditor within a county for the administration of drainage system records and process. So with that, members, I would be happy to entertain any questions you may have about the bill.
Questions from members from Mr. Kane. Senator Rosen.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is on 5.24, and perhaps you can just give me how it says incorporation of measures to reduce channel erosion. Is there anything in statute or directives establishing those procedures, or what is meant to reduce channel erosion?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I believe you're referring to Section 14. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Section 13, 5.24.
Okay, I must have a version that's a little bit outdated on the line numbers. So what we're doing under that provision of Subdivision 6 within Chapter 103E, Section 103E 701, which is repairs. And there had been a provision added, I believe, and I'm not completely certain about this, but I thought it was during the 1990s, in relation to increased focus on wetlands and water quality, that this provision would enable a watershed drainage authority to avoid a wetland with a repair or to otherwise restore or preserve, if you will. And the additional language that is being proposed to be added is the focus on erosion control and water quality. So this is something that drainage authorities already have the ability to do within repairs. It's just a clarification and emphasis within this subdivision.
Okay. Thank you.
Further questions from members of the committee? Is there anybody in the audience who wish to speak in favor of or against this bill or provisions of it? Are there any further questions on the bill? If not, Senator Rosen moves it. Senate File 113 be recommended to pass. And Senator Sparks, let's go straight to the floor now.
Yes. I believe so, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Senator Rosen moves that Senate File 113 be recommended to pass. On that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Sparks, we intentionally copied half the pages upside down because it's a confusing issue and we wanted everyone to be confused.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
I was properly confused.
That's good. Next, we have taking up presentations from the PCA, I believe, is first.
Oops.
Oh, we're doing confirmation. Ms. Heidinger, I guess, is coming up first, I guess. I'm told the agenda is different than what we thought. But while you're up there, why don't we go ahead with the confirmation. Ms. Heidinger, welcome to the committee, and if you'd like to make a brief statement or whatever, please go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Marty, and thank you to the members of the committee, all of whom took time to meet with me and gave me the opportunity to introduce myself and answer any questions that you might have. It is a privilege to stand before you today for confirmation, and if you have any additional questions for me, of course, I would be happy to answer them. I look forward to being able to serve in the position of chair of the Public Utilities Commission.
Thank you. Are there questions from members of the committee? I think your background qualifies you well for position on this board that is sort of a quasi-judicial type of role, and I hope you're enjoying it.
Thank you, I am.
Are there questions from members of the committee? If not, Senator Hoffman moves that the appointment of Beverly Jones Heidinger of St. Paul be recommended to the full Senate for confirmation as a member of the Public Utilities Commission. Is there any discussion of that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Good luck with your work on the PUC.
Thank you.
Now, since the agenda does say the next thing is, rather than go through the other confirmations, I think we'd like to go ahead with the presentations for the PCA. So welcome. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I need to find my PowerPoint here. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Galen Reitz. I'm the director of the Watershed Division at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Thank you for providing us with some time today. I'm going to present is just a little bit about the past, present, and future of improving water quality in the state, protecting and restoring water quality across the state. And I'm going to start out with just a few slides on kind of the foundation of where this all comes from. And in 1972, Congress passed the Federal Clean Water Act, which this really establishes the foundation for the goals that have been set in terms. The Clean Water Act set a goal for achieving fishable, swimmable waters by 1983. Which was a fairly optimistic goal, and we're still working to try and achieve that goal. And it establishes the framework for how we go about doing that. Essentially, the Clean Water Act identifies that states should designate and set standards for water quality in the state, assess, monitor, test, and assess all waters in the state, and identify those waters that do not achieve water quality standards or are impaired. It also identifies a process, the TMDL, or Total Maximum Daily Load process, for identifying how we would, what kind of reductions need to be made to restore waters that have been identified as impaired, and then ultimately identifying protection and control strategies for achieving our water quality goals. Impaired waters, or TMDLs as we focused on them, just a little bit of background on why there's been so much focus over the years on these. And in 2002, the legislative auditor identified that we weren't making very good progress on this, and identified it actually as a underfunded mandate, and that we really needed to do more to identify, evaluate, and restore waters that are impaired. In 2003, the Pollution Control Agency, as directed by the legislature, pulled together a diverse group of stakeholders to help make some recommendations on how we should proceed with moving forward on impaired waters. The stakeholders were a broad coalition, business and industry, agricultural interest, cities, the environmental groups, and the agencies all came together to really have a dialogue on how can we move forward on improving water quality in the state. In February of 2004, they came up with basically a set of recommendations, and then came back together in the summer of 2004 and made recommendations on a specific bill or legislation, which we now know as the Clean Water Legacy Act. And so then in 2005, actually in 2004, the cities of Annandale and Maple Lake both had wastewater treatment facilities that were overloaded, and they decided that they were going to come together and build a new wastewater treatment facility. The agency issued a permit for that facility. They discharged to the Crow River, which goes into the Mississippi, and there was a lawsuit that suggested that the agency should not have issued this permit because the discharge to a water that was impaired. The Minnesota Court of Appeals in 2005 essentially remanded that permit back to the agency, that we should not have issued it, and said, based on language in the Clean Water Act, that any source that causes or contributes or has the potential to cause or contribute, we could not issue a permit for such a facility until a TMDL was in place, a total maximum daily load, or a definition of what kind of pollutant reduction needs to be achieved. And I think this was really critical at the time. In 2005, the economy was still pretty good. We had to withdraw that permit. It immediately held up about six other permits, and over the next year about 30, and I think over the intervening years it's been many, many, many more. And essentially what this did was it really identified the importance of the state moving forward and completing TMDLs on impaired waters in the state, so that we didn't have something like this tying up economic development and growth in the state. Now, I have to say that in the recent years, this has kind of been a forgotten thing, because with the downturn in the economy, there hasn't been that much desire for growth. And so I think a lot of people have kind of forgotten that this is out there. But when the economy starts getting active again and growing stronger, this principle is still going to be out there, that we're going to be very limited on how we can issue wastewater permits if they discharge to an impaired water, unless a TMDL is in place. So this was a significant impetus for the state and for the stakeholders to say we really need to move forward with addressing impaired waters. Recognized this need. So in 2006, you passed the Clean Water Legacy Act, and just briefly, it said that we should identify impaired waters within 10 years, that we should develop, in the appropriation language, it actually said develop the TMDLs 10% per year, implement restoration activities, work to promptly delist those waters that had improved, comply with all Clean Water Act requirements, and it had one other very important thing. About 40% of the waters assessed in the state are identified as impaired. About 60% aren't. They're still in good shape. The Clean Water Legacy Act said the efforts should not only focus on those water bodies impaired, but also on protecting water bodies that are not yet impaired so they do not become impaired. So the approach that we had been taking to developing TMDLs prior to this was really a focus on meeting the EPA requirements. We were doing a single parameter, single segment at a time. They were really focused on only water chemistry. They ranged from small to huge. The Lake Pepin TMDL that we did was almost half of the state included in the watershed, just an overwhelming size. They took us from 48 years to complete. They were costly. And, you know, when we'd predict out how long will it take us to get through the state, I don't know if any of us have a real number, but it felt like the 100-year plan. And so with the direction from the Clean Water Legacy Act and that we should get through the state in 10 years, we recognized we had to adjust. We had to do things differently than the way we were doing them. And so we came up with an approach that really looked at how do we move through the state, do the monitoring and assessment of the condition of the waters, develop watershed restoration and protection strategies, including TMDLs, do the implementation activities, come around again and do the monitoring so that this time we only not only assess the condition, but we could also identify the effectiveness of the activities that had been implemented to move forward. So with that as kind of a background principle coming out of the Clean Water Legacy Act, what we've done is identify that we could not continue on the single parameter, single segment approach, and we needed to move to an approach of managing watersheds, managing the system. We're also now looking at the Clean Water Act says look at the physical, chemical, and biological. And so the first 40 years of the Act, we really focused only on the chemistry. We recognized that this interaction between the physical chemistry, which impacts the biological, we need to assess the whole system. We're looking at doing both restoration of impairments and protection of those that are not impaired. We've been working hard over the last few years to really develop tools and procedures that would make it possible to move forward with these pieces. And we needed to make sure that we were collecting the data so we could tell the story of the results and the success that's ahead, and also develop a system where we could maintain and track accountability for what was occurring. So this process, which we now call watershed restoration and protection strategies, the emphasis is really on how much of a pollutant reduction is necessary to both restore and protect. What are those pollutants? Where are they coming from? And then propose what kind of a pace of progress we can expect to achieve, including meeting the federal requirements of a TMDL so that the lawsuits don't hang us up and don't tie up the potential for economic growth in the state. At the point where we do that part and it's done in cooperation with local units of government. We always try and have a local project sponsor as a leader, so they are engaged and involved in the project. But then at that point, wastewater, stormwater activities, and feedlots, the regulated activities, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency continues to follow through on the implementation, but many of the non-point activities are managed and led by local units of government implementing various activities. And I'm going to not talk about really the right side of this chart. That'll Sarah Stroman is going to talk after me, and she'll fill in that connection. But what I wanted to just kind of emphasize is that there is kind of the what we were doing and what we're doing now. And, you know, pre-2006 or 2008, the federal TMDL requirements were really the driver. Now the driver is clean water for Minnesota. The scope has gone from just a single parameter and single impairments to impairments, but also protection of the water in the watershed. The scale was very variable. We have now come to a very consistent approach of, for greater Minnesota, of managing the 81 major watersheds in the state. We've expanded our focus from chemistry to chemistry, physical, and biological. In the past, these were taking 4 to 8 years. We are consistently getting down for the whole watershed, major watershed, to 4 years. Previously, it was really when we were doing TMDLs, it was really just driving permit decisions within the agency. Now, these are going to be able to drive our permit decisions, but also local implementation plans and action decisions that individuals will make on their own land. We still get the TMDL out of it, but we're also getting information on condition and assessment. We're doing work referred to as stressor ID. We're applying many very useful models and tools, and ultimately that these will be locally adopted and state-approved local watershed plans. Just on the costs, the range had been from about $100,000 to the Lake Pepin TMDL was almost $4 million. We now have focused these down to, for the TMDL development phase or the RAP phase, about $400,000 to $500,000 per major watershed. So we've seen a significant reduction in cost in the way we're doing these. Now, this is a point, I know you have a busy agenda today, so this is a point where I can either briefly go through what these RAPs would look like, or I can stop here and you can move on to the other speakers.
Mr. Reitz, I think we want to briefly go through what the RAPs would look like. Nod, nod, wink, wink, and then we'll move on.
I'll move through these quickly. So the Watershed Restoration Protection Strategies, we have one where we actually took an existing TMDL and backed it into what is going to be this new format. And some of the attributes of this new format are that we're trying to go from, you know, a pile of scientific documents to, we'll still have those, but we also want to end up with a much more visual, interesting document that will be more usable by our local partners. And so let me just kind of walk through this. So it starts out with the watershed monitoring. We do biological and physical, move around the state in 10 years. The map on the left identifies progress to date. We're about halfway through the state in the actual condition monitoring. We're on track to complete this within 10 years. The product that comes out of that monitoring assessment phase is basically a water quality study that compares the current conditions in the watershed, the lakes, the streams, the other water bodies, to designated beneficial uses, identifies impairments, and identifies waters that should be protected. The next step that we go to is what we refer to as the biotic stressor identification. And basically, this is a study of when we have biological impairments. This is a study that identifies the various stressors that are limiting fish in invertebrate communities in a stream or lake. We investigate hydrology, water quality, geomorphology, the biology, connectivity. Connectivity are dams, inlets, various sources, man-made structures coming into the stream. You can see that we're, again, about halfway through the state on doing this by each of the watersheds. The resultant product of this is we end up with, a very scientific report that identifies all the impaired waters and then identifies what the contributing pollutants are to those specific impairments. And what we're going to do is I'm not going to walk through each of these. I'm going to use one example from the bottom one, which is Drywood Creek, which identifies that the dissolved oxygen in the stream, the nitrogen levels in the stream, phosphorus levels in the stream, turbidity, altered hydrology, and habitat are what are causing an impairment to fish and invertebrates being productive. The next thing we do is we apply a model, which is HSPF, which is a hydrologic simulation program for Fortran, and it's a complex model that was developed by EPA, but it allows us to look at both point sources, non-point sources, take all the water quality data that has been collected, calibrate that, look at the watershed features, the soils, the topography, the flows, and pull all that information together so that we can better understand how these pieces all fit together. That tool helps us write these TMDLs. How much is coming from point sources? How much is coming from non-point sources? How much is coming from the various parts? And this report is the document that we still end up submitting to EPA for their approval and their check mark on have we completed a TMDL. So to just give you an example of what this would look like for the Pomme de Terre is a watershed in western Minnesota. If you look at the lower left, you'll see where it is. Morris.
Mr. Reitz, I'm sorry. I'm trying to catch up. Point source versus non-point source. Okay, could you clarify for the committee what that
certainly
what you just
I'm, said? Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Point sources are like wastewater treatment plant discharges. So it's a discrete source coming from a pipe. Non-point sources are general runoff from a variety of land uses and sources.
Thank you very much.
So this is the Pomme de Terre watershed. One of the things that we look at is a human disturbance score, which is looking at watershed land cover, riparian land cover, point sources, feedlots, stream channelization, and you can see and look at this map and see where there are more intensive land uses and disturbances by human activity. And so the red are the areas of higher disturbance. Green are the areas of lower. This then comes from the HSPF model. This happens to be channel scour and deposition. At the bottom of the watershed is where it drops into the Minnesota River, and so there's a significant drop there. That's why that's showing up as red, but you can see other areas that might give you reason to want to look and see what's going on there. This is a specific result related to sediment loading in terms of pounds per acre per day. And again, the red areas are kind of the hot spots, areas of that would be of concern. This is total phosphorus loading, pounds per acre. So you can see, without going into each of these in any depth, for brevity, you can see how this tool helps us start focusing down and targeting of where we're seeing sources of pollution. This one happens to be for total nitrogen, and I'll use this as an example. While we don't have water quality stream standards for nitrogen yet, this is an area where this was something that is causing a stress to the biological community, and so it might be something you'd want to focus on in terms of protection activities. If we want to protect and try and avoid getting to the point of an actual impairment at the point where there are standards. So what I'm going to do now is focus in on one specific area, which will be Drywood Creek, the one that's boxed right now. But we've got this information and data where what I'm going to show you now, we could focus in on any of these boxes that are identified. So this is that lower box, Drywood Creek, and this is just orthophotography, aerial view of what the watershed looks like. This is LIDAR data and information, and I know you probably can't see it well on the screen, but as you start looking at this, you can really start seeing features of the landscape. What we're able to do then is, say, look at the Environmental Benefits Index, which looks at water proximity to stream power index, soil erodibility, biological habitat. This is a tool that was developed by the Board of Water and Soil Resources in the University of Minnesota. And you can start looking at what are the top 5% areas that might need some kind of attention. And you can really start focusing in. And I'll just toggle back and forth. Sometimes this is hard to see. But the areas that show up in yellow there are potentially restorable wetlands. If you remember back in the Stressor Index report, one of the things that was identified was altered hydrology as a contributing problem. So we're going to have to figure out a way to start holding some water on the landscape here. This helps identify where there are potential wetlands that are restorable. This is a 100-meter riparian corridor, and I'm not. And this is turning on all of those together. But this is a tool that really allows all of our local partners to sit down together and start focusing in. And I'm going to just give you a quick example. When you take this information and then say, okay, what's it really look like on the landscape? We'll look at this location. And you can see that there's a fairly, that isn't a high power line there. That's actually a fence line that you can see those three silver streaks across the slide. But this is a fairly raw bank here along the stream. Another one where this would tell us to look, you have a fairly eroded stream bank. So once we have that, basically what we do is put together an implementation table for each of those areas where we want to sub-watersheds that you want to start focusing in on. And the information on the left, which are the boxes, the green column, or the columns that have the top is green, are essentially the information on reduction that goals and targets coming out of the various studies that have been done. The part on the right are with the blue headings are basically those parts of this implementation table that we would develop in cooperation with our local partners, so that it would be a team effort to identify what kind of strategies do we want to use to try and achieve the reductions and protect water quality for this water body. So this is basically the end. Ultimately, then it goes to implementing priority actions in targeted locations. So, Mr. Chairman, I will stop there. And if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. And that was a very brief overview. So,
thank you. Very well done. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for this great presentation. And I'm kind of taking notes because this is really interesting, and people ask me about this all the time in my district because they're curious about they voted for clean water money in 2008, and they would like to know what's happened with it and how are we progressing. So I'm just kind of wondering regarding the TMDLs, how many have led to delisting of the impaired waters, taking it off the list?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scalzi, at this point in time, I think there are actually 15 delistings. Right now there are 284 approved TMDLs, and those are all under the old method. We have about 30, just under 40 of the old style that are coming through the pipeline, the old style, and then everything else after that will be in the new approach of the RAPs, mm-hmm. which they range from including everywhere from 5 to 30 or more impairments within one. So, and so recognizing that there's a time lag between completion of the approved TMDL and then implementation activities and then actual delisting through the EPA process, because that only happens every 2 years. There are only about 15 at this point stream segments that have been delisted, and I think 3 or 4 lakes. But now as this is ramping up, I'm confident that we're going to start seeing the delisting ramp up, just like probably not quite as fast as we've been able to ramp up with the writing the studies, but hopeful and confident that we now at least have the tools in place that will allow us to get to those delistings.
Senator Scalzi.
And then just as a follow-up, I noted a lot of the language, for instance, locally adopted and state-approved local watershed plan, and then you mentioned in cooperation with local partners. And I'm wondering, how is that working? Are the local partners stepping up to the plate and taking care of these impaired areas that there is human degradation that we know of that may be non-point, but we know there is human degradation?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scalzi, I believe we have a very good working relationship, the state agencies with the local partners. I think that's great. I think that's progressing, and we all wish that the improvements would happen and could happen faster. But the reality is there's a bit of a delay and time lag between implementation of activities and then the response in the biological and stream system. So there is a bit of a delay. But I think as far as the relationship and the working relationship, that it's very good, and we're always careful to make sure that we have a local partner with these projects, because it isn't going to happen with just the state or just the locals. It's really about a partnership and working together to make the improvements, and ultimately the local landowners as well.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. I have a question kind of along the same lines, only on a larger scale. We have some of these mega TMDL studies. The one I know I'm aware of course, is Lake Pepin, right? Huge. 60% of the state's water drains into Lake Pepin. Lake Pepin's going to fill up with sediments one of these days. Maybe not in our day, but in our children's day, perhaps. Where are we on that, on some of those larger ones, including Lake Pepin?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble.
And are we going to continue on under the old method, or are we going to take a look at this RAPS kind of watershed-wide approach?
The Lake Pepin TMDL, or it's actually, we call it the Lower Mississippi Turbidity TMDL, and that it actually got split into two pieces. There's a phosphorus TMDL and a sediment TMDL. And the sediment TMDL has been completed. It was on public notice. We're working through some contested case hearing requests, and we're still working through that. So that hasn't been approved. The phosphorus TMDL is about a year behind. And so they're in process. But I think the most important thing is that implementing a TMDL on such a scale as that one is basically impossible. And so I think what we'll be looking at are implementation strategies at that scale, but we're really going to rely on what I showed you as far as those major 81, that scale, as where we're going to focus implementation activities, just because you can't work at the 60% of the state. We will still track it and monitor and track measures at that scale, but I hope we don't do any more of those large ones.
Further questions from the committee? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is Ms. Strumman next? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Stroman. I'm an assistant director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. I've been with the agency just a little over 2 months, but I'm very pleased to be here this afternoon to talk about the implementation of clean water protection and restoration efforts. Essentially, I am going to pick up the story where Mr. Reitz left off, and so I will be talking about the right side here of the chart that he showed earlier, and really focus on the role that the board and our local government partners play in watershed planning and in water protection and restoration efforts. My goal is really just to provide a brief overview. We do have a couple of our local partners here today, and I want to make sure we have time for you to hear from them, because I think it will make it very much more real for you to hear their stories of what they're doing on the ground. Just briefly, I wanted to cover the agency's mission. Our mission is to improve and protect Minnesota's water and soil resources by working in partnership with local organizations and private landowners. And I want to emphasize this because our focus on private land, I think, is really critical. 78% of the state's land is in private ownership. And so in order for the state to meet its clean water goals, it's very important for us to be working with those private landowners and the local organizations. Our business model then at the agency is one where we have a very small state staff, and we work through a local delivery network, which includes 90 soil and water conservation districts, 46 watershed districts, 87 counties, and 20 metro watershed management organizations. This local implementation approach is important not only because we have this established local delivery system, but because these local entities also have land use authority. And as we know, a lot of what goes into our water comes off the land. And these entities also have responsibility for local water management. Bowser does have authority to approve these local water management plans, and this includes the county comprehensive local water plans, the watershed district plans, the metro area watershed management organization plans, and then I'll talk a little bit later about this new category, which are comprehensive watershed management plans. I also just wanted to briefly note that these local units of government, their range of water issues that they have responsibility over, there's a wide range of water-related issues, and water quality is just one of those, although obviously an important one and our focus here today. So these plans really provide the guideposts for how we can use the tools that we have most efficiently and effectively. And there are sort of three categories of tools. We have education, so we can go out and try to make people aware of issues and try to convince them through education to do something different to improve our waters. We have projects and practices that we can put into place on the land, and typically we provide financial incentives for landowners to undertake these. And the third category is regulation. And so I'm really going to focus on the second category of projects and practices. Bowser provides funding to local governments via grants primarily, and these are to work on projects and practices that are laid out in state-approved and locally adopted plans or in approved TMDLs. And these projects then reflect the highest local priorities that are defined in those plans. And these maps here just show the range of and distribution of the clean water projects that we've funded over the past few years. I wanted to highlight a couple of examples of both a restoration and protection projects that we have funded at the agency. This first one is the Little Rock Lake project in Benton County. This is an example of a restoration project where there was an approved TMDL that dealt with a phosphorus problem in the lake. It's quite obvious when you look at these photos. So the TMDL that was approved set a phosphorus reduction goal. Bowser, through our clean water funds, funded the Benton SWCD to install some practices on the land that included pasture fencing, buffer strips, and also to work with local farmers on animal feed management strategies to reduce the phosphorus that was getting into the lake. And you can see that this project was able to achieve 11% of that phosphorus reduction goal that was laid out in the TMDL. The Fish Lake project in Jackson County is a good example of a restoration or of a protection project. I'm sorry. This lake is a high quality and important recreational lake for the county. It's a deep lake, which is pretty unique in that part of the state. And also unique is it supports a pretty high quality fishery and has a number of game species in there. And that's what that blue box is. It's showing the DNR fishery data for the lake. But as you can see from the photo there on the upper left, there was a threat to the water quality of the lake, basically from agricultural use nearby, where we were having these gullies that were going directly into the lake that were bringing sediment and nutrients into the lake and threatening the water quality. So through one of our clean water grants to the Cottonwood and Jackson SWCD, they were able to install a number of practices and ensure that these kinds of erosion were repaired and not occurring, and to keep this lake high quality and of its recreational value. I also just briefly wanted to mention that we do have a very active buffer program, and we implement this with the Soil and Water Conservation Districts. I'm not going to talk a lot about this because I believe Mr. Kalahar from Renville SWCD is going to talk about some of the buffer programs that they're working on. Finally, I also wanted to mention that in addition to practices on the ground, we also fund tools to help target the conservation practices. And Mr. Reeds talked about some of the LIDAR data that can be used to target where on the land practices will be most effective. So this slide just has another couple of examples of projects we funded to help local governments gain technology to help them better target and prioritize their actions. So the top graphic here shows a stacked hydrograph, which basically helps identify areas for water storage to prevent flooding, to reduce the frequency and magnitude of high flow events. And the bottom graphic there is the stream power index, which helps identify places where practices can go to reduce field or gully erosion into our waterways. Want to note, this is just a screenshot of our website. We fund many grants on an annual basis out of the Clean Water Fund, and for each of those, we require that the local governments provide us what we call clean water stories. And so it's a summary of the project, the practices, and the estimated pollution reductions that will be achieved through those projects. We put all of those up on our website, so they're available to the public, and they're kind of fun to look through and see the diversity of projects that are funded. We also have a booklet that we put together on many of those projects that are funded. So one of our goals really is to get that information out to the public. One thing I also wanted to note on this is there is very high demand from the local units of government for this clean water funding. Out of all the grants that we receive on an annual basis, somewhere between a half and two-thirds of the projects walk away with no funding because the demand is so much greater than the funding we have available. And you'll remember these are the highest priority projects that local governments are bringing forward, and somewhere between a half to two-thirds are walking away without their projects funded. Finally, I just want to talk a little bit about the watershed transition to a watershed approach that's going on with the local water management plans, which basically mirrors what Mr. Reitz talked about in the PCA's watershed approach and how they're transitioning from the old TMDLs to the watershed approach. Basically, Bowser and the local units of government have been working to mirror this transition to a watershed approach for local water planning, and that's what I mentioned earlier with the transition to a comprehensive watershed management plan. And so really it was some landmark legislation that was passed last year that allowed now local units of government to do water planning on a watershed basis. And so if you look at this map, the dash lines, which may be a little bit hard to see, but are the county lines, and then you'll see the watershed boundaries. So it would be transitioning from plans that are along those county lines to a watershed basis. We call this the One Watershed, One Plan initiative. It is recommended for funding this year in the governor's budget, so it would follow up on that policy legislation that was passed last year and actually fund the transition to unite the water planning efforts of the counties, SWCDs, and watershed districts. One thing to note of this is we, once the transition is complete, would reduce the number of water plans by half because these would be shared plans. And so, again, really the goal of this initiative, if it is funding, will help better define this handoff between the left side here, which Mr. Reitz went through on the wraps, to how the these local water plans define more specifically the implementation of those protection and restoration efforts, defining how to fix them, what specific practices, what priority sequence is needed, who will have the responsibility, and finally identifying the funding, how they will be paid for. We also hope that this funding will help us work to develop a template for these plans and really ensure that the implementation continues to be guided by the best science and tools available. And with that, I would like to conclude. I'd be happy to answer any questions. And as I said, we do have two of our local partners here today who will talk a little bit more in detail and I think provide some good examples of the great implementation that's going on in the ground.
Thank you, Ms. Stroman. Senator Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Stroman. I'm just wondering, from your testimony, you're saying that a third to a half are able to, of the projects are able to be funded. And I'm understanding that there's great demand for these funding. But after you do provide funding for the project, then how do you know and how soon do you know if the water is, in fact, getting better? I'm interested in outcomes. So how was the water quality progress measured?
Mr. Chair, Senator Scalzi, that's a good question. I'll answer it in a couple of ways. So for each of the projects that we fund, there's a pollution reduction estimator, and those are estimators based on models. So they're scientifically developed that give us an idea of what the pollution reduction will be based on the practices that are applied, you know, under similar conditions. It would obviously be very difficult to monitor hundreds and hundreds of sites to know specifically. So we use the best science and models to be able to estimate. And so we are able to get an idea. And as I showed, for example, the project that had the approved TMDL, there's a goal for what the phosphorus reduction needs to be. And we can then, with those models, estimate how much phosphorus actually was reduced. So we can show how much of that target we're meeting. On a long-term basis, and this, I think, is part of the reason, too, for the importance of the transition to the local plans to meet the watershed approach that the MPCA is doing with the RAP, is then on that 10-year assessment cycle, will also be monitoring on a watershed basis and able to see how well we're progressing on the water quality goals.
Ms. Senator Scalzi.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So you're saying we're going to be waiting 10 years for the assessment. So if you fund a project, do we have to wait 10 years, or are we going to see some results sooner than 10 years?
Mr. Chair and Senator Scalzi, I think we will be seeing results sooner than that. For example, you know, if we can show immediately, based on the models, how much pollution reduction we've seen. The monitoring cycle, however, occurs on a 10-year basis. And, you know, so if there's local monitoring going on, we may see results on a local scale sooner. On a watershed scale, it'll be on that 10-year cycle.
Mr. Stroman, on that same point to the Benton County project, if the project is going to reduce phosphorus by 11% of the goal, in other words, are you saying that 10 years from now, we find out, well, it did about 11%. How long do we move further on the other 90% of the goal?
Mr. Chairman, that 11% was anticipated to be achieved through just one project.
Okay.
So Benton County has other projects that come for funding through Bowser, which will also have additional estimates, which then get built on top of that 11%, as well as they may have other projects that are going on that don't come through our agency for funding that get measured. And so at some point, you can add up those percentages, and we hope they get to that 100%.
Other questions from the committee? If not, thank you very much. Are we moving to the local ones right now, the Minnesota River? Welcome to the committee. And I should say to all the folks who came here for these presentations a couple of days ago and apologize for the fact we had to postpone it. We never know how long session will take, and I apologize for having come here, but we thank you for coming a second time to make the presentations to us.
Chair, I'm just going to get... Mr. Chair, members, my name is Wendy Turry. I'm the Municipal Wastewater Manager at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Today I'm going to talk about the area that Mr. Reitz referred to as point sources and implementation of the TMDL for a point source. So I'm going to talk about wastewater facilities and how it relates to phosphorus and the Minnesota River. Okay, a little bit about the Minnesota River. This is the basin. And the red dots I'll be referring about throughout the presentation, and those are the 39 larger facilities within that Minnesota River Basin. And then the green triangle, or blue triangle, sorry, on here are the areas where we've done monitoring. And this is also the area where, when we've done monitoring, we found low oxygen in the river. So, again, I'll be talking more about that as we go along. Okay, a little bit of background. In that area that where those blue triangles are, that's where we've historically found a low dissolved oxygen when the flow in the river has been low. In 1988, this was very low dissolved oxygen, and actually there was a fish kill, a pretty famous fish kill in Lake Pepin, I think most of you probably know about. In 1992, we listed this as an impairment. So EPA got it. It was listed as an area in the river that was impaired. And then in 2004, we actually wrote a TMDL. We did a study and did a TMDL that was approved by EPA for this area. One other piece of information that I think is useful is up until this point, wastewater facilities, when they discharged, they did not, unless they discharged directly or pretty close to a lake, they didn't have to treat for phosphorus. So those 39 that you saw, those facilities, there were no lakes. They didn't have to, for the most part, treat for phosphorus because there wasn't any requirement for them to have to do that. Okay, it's over the years of working in wastewater, people get sort of confused about, well, why does phosphorus matter to oxygen? So the problem in the river is oxygen. Wastewater plants, you know, discharge quite a bit of phosphorus, or they can if they don't treat for it. So I'm going to just give a little lesson on why that is. The area in the river that is of concern during low flow is an area that goes from 3 feet to 10 feet deep. And so when that happens, the flow slows down significantly, and in particular when the flow is low. And what happens is algae, phosphorus is a really good plant food, and algae is a plant. So we're in low flow, there's even more algae in the river because of there's more phosphorus in the river if there isn't wastewater treatment. So the algae builds up in this area where the flow is low and it's deeper. And then what happens is it starts settling to the bottom, and it's a plant and it needs sun to live, it starts dying off. And once it dies off, the bacteria have to break it down. So, you know, it's dead, and they're breaking it down. When they do that, they use up oxygen. And so that's what happens. They start using up oxygen in the river, and then the river doesn't support aquatic life. So that's sort of the connection between phosphorus and oxygen. Okay, so we did this study, and I think for the most part we kind of knew what was going to happen, but what we know that in order to support aquatic life, a healthy aquatic system, we needed a 5 mg/L oxygen in the river. We also, and that's during, well, it's always, but in particular during low flow. We also knew that we're going to have to reduce phosphorus during low flow. That's what the study showed us. That was a little bit of a surprise. We thought there would be other parameters, but the study showed, the models show that really phosphorus was the culprit. Then when we looked at the sources, we realized that, you know, 65% of it was from wastewater facilities. And of those 65%, 91% was from those 39 red dots that I showed you in that map. So, you know, what do we do? So basically now we realize that the bulk of the problem is from our wastewater facilities, and we need to do some implementation. We met with, you know, the wastewater facilities in the area and other stakeholders, including environmental groups. We had EPA there. We met for over a year to figure this out. And what we decided to do was to issue what we call a permit. But it was kind of overlaid. All these facilities in there already had a permit, so it went over the top, and it had a number of requirements. One of the big ones was those 39 red dots, those larger facilities, had to reduce their phosphorus in 10 years by 51%. So that was a pretty substantial amount. The other thing that it did, and this was really a first for Minnesota, is it set up a system for trading from one wastewater facility to another. We'd had a couple point source to non-point source trades, but this was actually a simple way to do trading from, you know, a wastewater facility to wastewater facility. It also, as a result of the trading, they had to, if say they needed 100 pounds, if they were an existing facility, they would have to buy 110, and that extra 10 would get retired. And if they were a new facility, they had to buy 120, so there was a 20% reduction, and 20% would get retired. Additionally, this permit required that the smaller ones, there was between 80 and 90 smaller wastewater facilities, they had to do something to start looking at reducing their phosphorus. And then lastly, there were 13 unsewered communities that had discharges into the river that were we said had to have start taking steps toward resolving those problems. So we did this permit, and now what are the results of the permit? Well, this was a huge success. And what we found was during this time of this permit, we had 7 new facilities come into the basin. Now, they couldn't have, the basin basically was capped. We can't add any more phosphorus, so they had to have a zero discharge of phosphorus. So they all had to come in by trading. So this permit allowed for, you know, economic development by this trading. It also, on average, we've been having about 19 trades per year. All of the 13 unsewereds that were identified in this permit are either fixed or in the process of being fixed. And then for the smaller facilities, they are all monitoring, for, you know, their phosphorus, and they're also doing what we call phosphorus phosphorus management planning. And basically what that means is that they have to look at what are their sources of phosphorus and are there ways for them to reduce that phosphorus within their wherever they're finding them. And then also if they've, the smaller facilities have expanded during that time, their loads, their amount of phosphorus has been capped so that they've had to basically treat to meet what they currently stayed at. So four of them have done that to date. And then the 39 facilities, which had to meet a 51% reduction in 10 years, have actually met it early. They met it in 7 years. And this graph does a little bit better job of showing that, that we'd kind of given them a step down, and by 2007, I remember what their deadlines were. But regardless, 2015 was when they're supposed to meet their final goal, and they've actually met it last year. So they've done a really good job of ramping down their phosphorus. Some of them are still going to be building. You know, some of them are still meeting by trading. So we expect that this will even go down further. Okay, so the wastewater plants have done a really good job of reducing their phosphorus. How does this translate into the river? Like I said earlier, it's a low flow problem, so we can only really monitor when there's been low flow, and we haven't had a lot of low flow, although last year we did have low flow. It wasn't quite as low as when we listed it, so it wasn't a complete comparison, but we were able to at least see where the river was at. And so I know this is a really busy slide, so I'd like you just to look at the part where the red is boxed in. And there you can see that if you look at the phosphorus from where it was in 1980 to where it is and was in 2012, we've almost cut it in half. And so it's a significant reduction. Additionally, if you look up under the next one up where it says DO, which is for dissolved oxygen, you can see that that is actually the lowest level that they measured throughout the summer, and we actually still met the limit during this really low flow, and actually was a warmer, higher temperature in the river than we've had before. So again, we feel like not only did the wastewater plants do what they needed to do to reduce their phosphorus, the river has shown that it's responded to the work that they've done. Okay, so in conclusion, you know, what we see, there's no violations of the 5 mg/L standard for oxygen. We've got much lower phosphorus in the river. You know, we see that the wastewater facilities have significantly, improved the water quality in the river, and we've been able to maintain the oxygen levels at, lower flows than we have in the past. So I guess I'd like to say that this was a success story for 100 and some wastewater plants, but I'd also like to say that we are doing, many more efforts. Wastewater plants are treating for in other areas of the state. And this graph does a nice job, although again it's busy, of showing if we weren't doing the efforts that that are going on throughout the state, that blue line shows where we think we would be. And then if you look at the green and the yellow lines, and then we're predicting out further, that's where we are today based on our current efforts. So you can see we're reducing our phosphorus probably by 2/3 statewide.
Thank you, Mr. Reed. Questions from the committee? Mr. Osmond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question, you've been focusing on storm from the point of wastewater. What types of directions are you going to be taking perhaps in the future on stormwater? I know in the city that I live in, we dump untreated stormwater off of streets basically into the top of Lake Minnetonka and let it flow through the system, which is probably not the most ideal thing to do. Are there additional activities that are going to be taking place to try and reduce the phosphorus through those methods or through those entry points?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm the wastewater expert, so I'm not. I can talk briefly about that and get back. We can get back to you and get you more information. We are working on a permit works with communities that will help better address sources from that are causing problems with the impaired waters. And, in terms of exactly how that works, I'm not the expert in that, and we can get back to you.
No problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Turi. I think you're fish graphic was very much appreciated by.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next, we have the Maplewood Mall case study.
Senator Marty, committee members, thanks for having me here today. My name is Cliff Eichinger. I'm the administrator with the Ramsey-Washington Metro Watershed District. It's a long name. The question regarding stormwater from cities I will deal with. I am here today, I've been asked to be here today to talk about two, not just Maplewood Mall, but also a Maplewood Living Streets project, two clean water funded projects that are putting those funds to good use. I will talk about why we completed these projects, our project goals, what was done on the ground, and outcomes. The stormwater retrofit, actually we call it the stormwater volume reduction retrofit project for Maplewood Mall. It is a result of a TMDL, so I will discuss how that happened. I'd like to point out, though, that none of these projects could be effectively completed and effectively designed without considerable planning up front. And I know that a lot of people are interested in seeing projects on the ground, and that's fine, and we like to do that too, but we can't do that effectively without doing a lot of planning. And this project actually resulted from five different plans. It's an iterative process, and unfortunately it's not a straight line sometimes. We did a Phelan Chain of Lakes project back in the late 80s. We updated that plan in about 2004 and tried to look at what are the reasons and what are the causes for the current water quality levels in those lakes. Coleman Lake is the upstream lake of a four-lake chain and was designated as impaired for excess nutrients, primarily phosphorus. And it's a shallow lake, and it's difficult to control and lower phosphorus levels in shallow lakes because you get a lot of internal loading as well. It's a process where there's a lot of built-up sediment and phosphorus in the bed of the lake, which then gets resuspended by a number of things. So we identified that we needed to do a 90% reduction in Coleman Lake's internal load and 25% more reduction in the phosphorus loading from the watershed. And this study actually showed that we needed to do a lot of reduction in the watershed, but also that this was resulting from dissolved phosphorus. Phosphorus has two constituents, phosphorus connected to particles and phosphorus that's dissolved in the system. The particle phosphorus, we've done a very effective job in removing over the past 20 years that the district's been implementing capital improvement projects. And those can be accomplished through open water ponds and other types of best management practices that we've been implementing. But what is still getting through the system is this dissolved piece, and that is very difficult to remove. So we then evolved into a project and a study to find out where are these sources of phosphorus coming from and what are the potential methods to reduce that. This resulted in a study which was very interesting. If you see the box on the right, 40% of our land area is covered by streets, parking lots, and driveways, highways and interstates as well. But this generates almost 70% of our phosphorus load. So obviously, we then identified that we need to attack impervious surfaces. We need to reduce the volume of water coming off our impervious surfaces within the watershed. Let me point out, we're almost 100% developed, and we have very little vacant land except for parks. And so we're in a situation where we have to, what we call retrofit, existing systems. We did do a study of our watershed, to find out, we do have rules in place, by the way, another one of our authorities. These rules require the collection of permits for construction projects. Any construction project over an acre has to first infiltrate the first inch of runoff from their property. So that is a dramatic technique that a number of people are now using in urban areas. But we analyzed what the impact of that reduction would be, and we found that we needed, it only met about 40% of our goal over the next 20 years. So we knew that to add to that, we had to retrofit existing impervious areas. So we looked at the watershed, and just upstream of Coleman Lake, if you're familiar with the area, in Maplewood, is the large Maplewood Mall. There is 70 acres of imperviousness, 100% impervious area within the perimeter ring road of the mall. Surrounding the mall is another 100 acres of impervious area that we knew that if we could manage to infiltrate the first inch of runoff over that surface, we would do a dramatic improvement to the phosphorus loading. So our goals were to capture, remove, try to remove the volume as well as infiltrate the stormwater, capture 68% of the water of the first inch of runoff on the site. We wanted to have a successful collaboration with a major landowner. Let me add to this that rural areas in Minnesota have to work with private landowners. Obviously, they own a majority of the property. In the past, in urban areas, we've been able to do a lot of stormwater treatment using public property or property that we buy. We're now in a situation with so little vacant land that we have to start doing collaborations with private landowners. This was a new area to deal with, and we had some discussions with Bowser on this, that it is a different thing with to get a clean water grant through Bowser and deal with private property where we don't have permanent easements or ownership. So we wanted to demonstrate this could be done. We wanted it to be cost-effective, and we wanted to implement above-ground features so that the public could see what we're doing. The mall was very concerned about the appearance of the features, maintenance responsibilities, disruption to shoppers coming to the mall. They have a number of anchor tenants they have to keep happy, so that was an issue. And they wanted to limit the loss of parking. They basically had an excess of parking, but not a lot. They have to meet certain standards in cities. So we looked at a number of different what we call BMPs, best management practices, that were possible to implement on this site to treat the stormwater. Rainwater gardens, you're probably all familiar with. We looked at using porous pavements, underground detention and infiltration, basically pipes or systems that are built underneath the pavement that take in stormwater. Those would not be visible, which is one of our criteria. And tree trenches, which can be implemented, still maintain parking over the top of them, but have a tremendous infiltration capacity and allow us to grow trees in a parking lot that's entirely paved. So we did settle on a number of different techniques, primarily rain gardens, porous pavement, and tree trenches. It was a four-phase project. I should say that we've been working on this project for 6 years. It was just completed last fall. It was a long time coming, and there should be a handout, colored handout on your table that shows the cost of the project and some measures of benefit. The project was in four phases, and the first phase was entirely funded by the district, included rain gardens at the entrances. Phase two and three was the north half of the mall that included tree trenches, more rain gardens, and an enhanced sand filter. And phase four was the south half of the mall with more rain gardens and tree trenches. A picture of one of the entrance rain gardens that last year was much more grown than this and beautiful. We tried to incorporate innovative techniques. It's one of the things our district strives for because we know that the standard conventional methods don't always work and they tend to decrease their efficiency over time and require a lot of maintenance. Innovative techniques take some research, they take some testing, but in the long run we see a real payoff. One of these is now iron-enhanced sand. We've done a couple of these projects throughout the district, and iron aggregate added to sand at about a 5% per weight ratio can attract dissolved phosphorus, and we can run over 30 years of stormwater through the system, and it's still attracting over 80% of the dissolved phosphorus that runs through the system. It's a tremendous potential resource for urban areas that don't have much land to use. We put this in all this sand, all the rain gardens. There's a sand filter in the middle of the rain garden before the outlet perforated pipe, and the sand filter on the north end of the project has this as well. More rain gardens with enhanced sand. The tree trench was an innovative technique that was adapted from what's called the Stockholm tree trench system in Stockholm, Sweden. It provides for water to get into an underground bed of rock that basically fills up with stormwater, and the trees are able to send their roots down into the rock and grow tremendously fast. Their root systems are very robust. They have adequate water because of the water that stays on the pores of the rock, and it allows us to both filter and infiltrate stormwater. This shows it partially under construction with the underground pipes, and this shows a finished product with the grates and around the trees. The other feature I wanted to point out was that we don't just try to do things with stormwater. Our part of our responsibility is to educate the public. So we incorporated features into this project that provide for possibly reaching 10,000 visitors a year. At the east end of the mall, there is a we expanded the entrance plaza by over doubling the size. We added a cistern with some interactive pumps that kids can pump and entertain themselves, putting in a big tile mural. And we have a number of signs that we installed that interpret the features we put into the mall. This has been tremendously popular. The mall is very excited about this and is encouraging us to have more events at the mall that interpret our stormwater project. Let me go on to the Maplewood Living Streets project quickly. One of the other ways that we know that we can reduce the volume of water is to reduce the amount of impervious surface within the watershed. We've been building streets according to a standard that was basically adopted back in the 60s. And that is a standard 32-foot wide street with curb and gutter and get the water away as quickly as possible. We know that that led to a lot of problems in the watershed. The approach has been basically to favor the gray side of the infrastructure, the roads and the storm sewers and utilities, and pretty much ignore the other side, the pedestrian safety, the handling of stormwater, allow for safe biking and aesthetics. So we're the living streets, or green streets, as you might have heard of it, favors balancing those two elements, not limiting traffic and being able to move by car, but also recognizing that we need to manage stormwater, we need a safe place for our kids to bike and walk, and improve the aesthetics of the neighborhood. So these are just a couple of graphics. I'll whip through these quickly, but basically it's reducing the pavement width, still providing for movement of vehicles, but also providing for rain gardens on the side, boulevard trees, and sidewalks for safe movement. The project was done in what's called the Bartlemy Meyer neighborhood. It's east of McKnight Road and just north of Minnehaha on southern Maplewood, just north of the 3M campus. And it covered 2 miles of city streets that would have been rebuilt as a 32-foot wide standard street. They're now done at 24 feet wide with a sidewalk on every street on one side. And we reduced the impervious cover by over an acre. From 6.5 to 5.5, we installed 32 rain gardens plus one regional rain garden, and we're storing 19,000 square feet of rain gardens and 18,000 cubic feet of water treated. So this is a couple of showed before and after. With the sidewalks installed in the lower one, you'll see we wrapped around the rain gardens, so it's a kind of a curvilinear sidewalk. The neighborhood likes it. This shows what a 30-foot street would have been and what a 24-foot street is. Still allows for two drive lanes and one parking lane on one side. So what's next? This is a pilot. We wanted to develop an example where cities could see how to do this effectively and that it does meet the needs of transportation and the residents. Maplewood has made this a standard in their street reconstruction project. We will be monitoring to document long-term results. And we have presented this to a number of cities and at a number of conferences and received very good acceptance, and we think it will be expanding its popularity. So with that, I would gladly take some questions and hand it off to Renville County.
Thank you, Mr. Eichinger. Are there questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Renville County.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Yep, I just want to attest to the great work of Mr. Eichinger and the Ramsey Washington Watershed District for their community engagement and education, being that they took initiative in starting the Steward of Change, Steward of Phelan Change of Lakes, and it's all based on volunteerism that reach out to our diverse community member in my district and. Senator Wigger District. Yep. So thank you very much.
And it's nice to see the community involved. And I think when you like at Maplewood Mall, I think the businesses and the customers like to see what's been changed. Renville County, welcome to the committee.
My name is Tom Kelleher, and I'm the senior. I'm a senior conservation technician at Mineral County Soil and Water Conservation District, and pretty much the opposite of what you just saw. I'm going to be talking to you about. I'm from Renville County, which is about 85 miles straight west of here on Highway 212. Fairfax, Redwood Falls, Granite Falls would be some of the towns along the Minnesota River there. The entire southern end of Renville County pretty much is bordered by the Minnesota River, and it's one of the Soil and Water Conservation District's very high priority rivers is because of the fact, you know, that there's a lot of opportunity, and it is truly a beautiful river. It carries our namesake, and we really need to respect it a little bit more in the future than we have in the past. The photo that you have up here, I kind of got the good and the bad and the ugly for you here. I do a lot of recreation on the Minnesota River. This happens to be one of our foreign exchange students from Norway. Had to show her exactly what we have in Renville County and the intensely agricultural part of the state. Renville County is about 650,000 acres, with 90% of it under agricultural, the agricultural industry. The Minnesota River is also very diverse in its fisheries. Anybody know what this is? This happens to be a shovel-nosed sturgeon. One of the few sturgeons that we have in Minnesota. It's a native sturgeon to the Minnesota River. And because of the efforts of improving water quality in the Minnesota in the last 25 years, population of shovel-nosed sturgeons is on the increase. There are some real positive things going on in the watershed along with some negatives. This, again, is our Norwegian friend, again, holding up a channel catfish, which the Minnesota River of the upper reaches of the Minnesota is an absolute world-class channel catfish fishery, probably one of the best fisheries in the state. And we have a lot of people that actually come to the Minnesota River, the upper parts of the river, to fish. It's a part of Minnesota that's been somewhat neglected, and we need to make sure that we spend some time and initiatives there to try to protect this beautiful landscape. Here's kind of the ugly part. This is the same river, pretty much just upstream a little bit at a different time of the year. This is a high flow time. As you can see, the river finds its own course, and as we continue to outlet more water in the Minnesota, it has to find a room to store that water. It does, thank God, the Minnesota, it has an extensive floodplain, but before it pops out of that riverbank onto the floodplain, it does a considerable amount of damage. If you look at the skeletons there on the edge of the riverbank, those trees were all standing living trees a couple of years before that, and what happens is that because of the amount of water or the volume, the increased flow in the Minnesota River, we constantly see this eroded banks wherever the river has to make a turn or a sharp turn, and it's adding a tremendous amount of sediment to the Minnesota and downstream. If you look at this large hole, you can see it right to the north of the I'm the only one that knows that's north of that big root ball, but you can see the hole there. That's where that tree once was. And that big hole that's caused now because the tree's not there is all into the river and on its way down to the Gulf of Mexico. A lot of the problems associated with the Minnesota, we always talk about water quality, but water quantity is definitely an issue that we need to spend more time on. It's because it's the amount of water in the Minnesota that is the biggest threat right now to that beautiful landscape. This is kind of a darker picture, but the vegetation up there on the bank is a cornfield. And each year that cornfield gets a little smaller and a little smaller and a little smaller, you know, and we really need to emphasize on stream bank erosion. We really need to emphasize on buffer strips, which my colleague Jason will talk about here in a little bit. But those are just an upfront on the river view of what the river would look like if you all want to come out and take a look at it firsthand, and I would be more than glad to do that for you all. What's happening on the landscape in Renville County should be shocking. It shocks me, and it should shock the rest of you. The amount of tiling in Renville County is explosive. We have about 850 miles of drainage ditch in Renville County. That's about here to almost Denver. We have 3,500 miles of subsurface public drainage tile system. That's about from Miami to Seattle. That's a lot. At present rate of installing new drain tile, we are doubling our tile system, our underground tile system, every 2 years. And all two-thirds of that water will go to the Minnesota, and one-third will go to the Crow or the Mississippi. And so as you can look into the future of how much water are we going to be sending downstream from the agricultural part of the state, by looking at what we're doing today, I think it's pretty easy to assume that we're going to be sending more water down and not less. And so water quantity is certainly, in my book, as important, if not more so, than quality. This is what pattern tile looks like. And what happens is that, agriculture has had some very good years, and that a lot of that money gets plowed back into land improvement. Basically what we're doing out there now is retiling all of our farmland. Pattern tiling is called, and every 50 or 60 feet, there's a tile line across the field. And then we have to have an outlet, of course, and so then we put in an outlet, and you see this outlet, this black pipe that's entering, and the water from that pattern tile system now is going down into this little creek, or this ravine actually is what it is. I'm just going to back ahead here just a little bit. This is what happened some years down the road to that ravine that I just showed you, with that had the trees and the wooded trees on it. After years and years of being saturated and flooded, and there's a constant trickle of water now from that tile system, and what happens is it destabilizes the bottoms of the woods, and they start to slough. And all of the soil that you now see that is not here anymore, that's displaced, has been going down the river or down the ravine. And let me back this up a little bit. That was what it looked like in the beginning, and the other pictures were is what it looked like in 10, 15 years from now. Along with that, we're seeing some land conversion. This picture here is a site of about 200-year-old oak trees that have been removed. It is now a cornfield. And if you look at the lay of the land here and the edge of the trees there that were bulldozed onto the bluff, that is the bluff of Beaver Creek, and that falls off now at about 100 feet. And so basically what we've done here is pattern tiled the adjacent field upstream, and then we removed the 10 acres of oak trees right next to the bluff, and we're going to be creating a situation here that I'm sure that somebody from my office will be back out here in a few years trying to fix some of this stuff out here. So we really need to start looking at what we need to prevent future problems because we've got so many past situations that it's going to take us a long time to fix those. So, here's another good example, though, of what happens to that ravine I was telling you about. Right here's a tree, that keeps sliding down, and that happens year after year after year once that ravine has become unstable. Here's another thing that's going on. This was about 100 acres of CRP. It had a wetland restoration. The darker area there just off to my right of the tile was a nice cattail slough or wetland. That tile is laying there being ready to put in the ground. Today, that is a completely tiled out black 100 acres and probably never to return. And that water, of course, will be heading south as soon as spring comes. This is a field in Renville County that was in the Reinvest in Minnesota program, a limited program for 10 years. It came out 20 years. It was a limited reinvest in Minnesota. It came out in 2008. This is a picture from last spring on a 4-inch rain. What happened here is that it got replanted back into corn. The silt and the amount of water that ran off this field was so heavy that it filled up the road ditch, and you can see where somebody must have drove through the silt there. They had just got done putting in a new bridge and a new pipe here, the county did, township, and it basically washed out their new pipe, and you can see where the riprap there has been pushed off into the Beaver Creek. This is Beaver Creek again. It's got its troubles. And the guy that's standing down there on that sediment bar there, that's what's left of the dirt that came off that field. What you can't see is all the dirt that went downstream. And these are situations that the clean water money that we didn't have prior to a few years ago. We are working with these landowners, and it's our hope that we're going to have this land taken care of in the next year or two. But it takes a lot of money in order to be able to fix situations like this. This landowner here, the young farmer, just, you know, he needs land badly. So he's in a situation where he's going to plant it regardless and kind of take what he gets, unless we can offer him something better. Like I mentioned before, Renville County has 851 miles of drainage ditch, almost from here to Denver. And most of our drainage ditches look like this. They were dug back in the 1950s. Cheap and deep is basically the way we did it. They were built for a drainage system that was a yesterday's system. Today, we have overloaded every one of these drainage ditches to the point where they're not functioning like they should. And, of course, we farm right up to the edge of a lot of them, and we cause ourselves a fair amount of problems. If you look at this picture here, we've got a little bit of conservation tillage over here, but we got almost black ground here, and we're within a foot of the downslope of the drainage ditch. This is what happens along the drainage ditch. Again, you destabilize the ditch banks, and not only do you get erosion coming off the fields and into the ditch itself, but you destabilize the ditch bank and you get these sloughings. You can see the stuff that was once grass off that hole that's laying down in the drainage ditch. We spend about $400,000 to $1 million a year in Renville County cleaning out drainage ditches. And that's money that we could spend somewhere else if we kept the soil out of the drainage ditch in the first place. So what are we doing about this? The Soil and Water Conservation District, number one, our biggest priority is to buffer the 851 miles of drainage ditch in Renville County. And we plan on doing that within the next X many years, depending on funding. And Jason will tell you a little bit about where we've spent the clean water money in the last couple of years and how much money that it would take in the next few years in order to be able to do just that. And drainage ditch buffering seems to be something the agricultural community has embraced. So I think this is a doable thing, but it's going to take time. It's going to take a fair amount of funding.
Thank you, Tom. My name is Jason Beckler. I am a Farm Bill technician with the Renville County SWCD, and my position is funded through a grant through the LCCMR. Like Tom said, we got a lot of miles of drainage ditch. We got more miles of drainage ditch in Renville County than what we do Township Road. So that kind of gives you an idea where our priorities lie within Renville County. Renville County is number one in rim easements. So I think that's a shining example how conservation and a community can coexist. Right now, we have a clean water-funded rim buffer easement program going on right now through Bowser. And I'm happy to say Renville County is number one in the state of Minnesota for getting people enrolled on a voluntary basis in the buffer program. And as Tom said earlier, it's our goal to try and get at least a 50-foot buffer on every drainage ditch in Renville County. So far, we've had two sign-ups in Renville County, and we've enrolled over 900 acres in buffer strips. And we have over $5 million spent on those buffer strips for Renville County. But it's going to take roughly $62 million at the average rim rate to get people to put a buffer easement on a drainage ditch in Renville County. So we've had good success, but we got a ways to go. And unfortunately, it takes funding if we're going to get this accomplished on a voluntary basis. Landowners aren't going to do this if it's not mandatory. And so we have to go to them and talk finances with them. And it seems to make sense. We're not going to get wetlands restored in some of these areas that we commonly refer to as a black desert. They're drained. They're gone. Tom showed you the pictures. We're not going to get them back. But like Tom said, we're able to get buffer strips in some of these areas. So it's a way for us to get conservation footprint in some of these areas that are ag-dominated. So that's been a lot of success. And so I guess with that, that's kind of where we're at. And if you guys have any questions.
Well, we'll I'll show you a few more slides and then a couple of more points. This is a photo of a drainage ditch, of course, that does not have a buffer system over here on the upper. And you can see that there's a lot of snow in the drainage ditch itself, which, of course, will be downstream come next spring. And then you can see that the snow is not nice and white. It's pretty dark black, and that's from wind erosion over the winter months. If you look at the other photo, that's got a 100-foot buffer strip, and you notice that there's not any snow in the drainage ditch itself. It's laying out on the native grasses that are planted in the buffer strip, and the snow is still pretty white. And they just make a lot of sense. It moves that farming operation off of the drainage ditch as far as water quality goes. The pesticides and fertilizers that we apply are removed to 100 feet away from the drainage ditch, and the opportunity for those to get into the drainage ditch is lessened greatly. But the drainage ditch buffering effort is also sanctioned by the Renville County Commissioners and the Drainage Authority, and so I think that we have a very good chance at reaching our goal sometime in the future. The other thing, the other place that we have spent clean water money on is feedlot, and I am the feedlot inspector for Renville County. I inspect about 400 feedlots every 4 years, so about 100 a year, and my job is to go out and make sure that they are in compliance with MPCA feedlot rules. And believe it or not, every now and then we find some that aren't, and so it's our job to help them fix those. This was a good example of how our clean water money is being well spent. If you look at this picture behind me here, right here is the two silos, the feedlot. This was basically a wetland that was caused by manure runoff. Most of the runoff off of this whole feedlot operation, there was about 300 head of milk cows here, was running down into two tile intakes that were located about right here. And it worked fairly well for the landowner just simply because of the fact that the drainage on the feedlot was super because it would flow on down there and it'd run down the tile intakes and it was gone. They had so much manure off this lot that it would run off in here, so then they had hauled out here and they would pile it in a great big pile. This was below ground here too, so they had another big tile outlet right there in order to be able to move around, you know, in the spring and stuff. And so when I inspected that, I went, you know, we've got kind of a problem here, and they knew they did. We worked with them, spent a fair amount of money. But if you look at, here's the two silos again. Right here is about where those two intakes were in that wetland. Basically what we did is we captured all the water that ran off of the feedlot, funneled it into a chute. We removed all the tile, of course. And then the tile intakes were right about here. All of the runoff now is, and it runs down here, and it's pushed into this big pit. And it is stored into that street big pit, and it's got over a year's storage. And so they had to haul their manure every day out on the field because they didn't have the capacity to store it. And whenever you haul manure in the wintertime out on the field, you put it up on top of the snow, of course some of that's going to run off again, but you lose 50% of the value of the fertilizer in the manure. And so what has enabled this person to do here is, number one, to stop polluting Fort Risley Creek in the Minnesota River,
it's allowed him to be able to store the manure to the point where now it's a valuable asset, and he's reduced his commercial fertilizer bill considerably by being able to utilize the manure in his pit to its highest value. That would not have been possible without the help of the Clean Water Funds and, of course, our partners through the NRCS, USDA. And by the way, you heard a fair amount of word about local partners. Well, that would be us almost all the time, soil and water conservation districts, counties. We're the people that work with the other state agencies. We're the boots on the ground, so to speak. And I'm probably on 120 to 150 farms a year. And so we have a pretty good idea on what's happening around us what we need to do. My last slide is kind of what we're up against. This is supposed to be funny. It's a cemetery. And I just hope they don't get any closer, because they're getting pretty close now, you know. But there's a lot of pressure on the landscape out there because of $8 corn and $20 soybeans to farm all of it. That's going to cause some problems. We need to be able to balance the landscape a little bit more than we have in the past. And so I hope that you all will continue to support the efforts of the Clean Water Program, is because it's absolutely important for the work we do out here.
Thank you, Mr. Keller. And Mr. Markle, or is it? I didn't catch your name earlier.
Jason Beckler.
Beckler. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. There are questions from the committee. Senator Scalzi.
You know, this isn't a question, and you people are doing the best that you can, but I just have to say how disgusting it is that we're spending, every time we buy an item that's not food or clothing, we're spending money to clean up something that someone has created who is making $8 a bushel for corn, who should be cleaning up their own mess. Honest to God, this is just, it's just disgusting. I don't know what else to say.
Well, and to add upon that, they're also getting direct payments from the Farm Service Agency.
Absolutely.
And subsidized crop insurance. So
we need to do better. There is no doubt about it. But without organizations like ours, and people that are concerned about water, water quality, water quantity, I mean, it's absolutely imperative that we keep these local interest strong, is just simply because of the fact that we're in really bad shape if we don't.
Mr. Kelleher, when you said you went on the one farm and you said, "What great for them," when you meet with the farmer like that, how many times do, when you're done with them, they feel, okay, I see the problem, I see how this would be a better solution, and so on? How many times is it that versus a hostile kind of?
I would say that 99% of the time it is a friendly, I've been in Renville County for 34 years. I don't believe I have too many enemies. And I've been in a regulatory program, both Wetlands Conservation Act and the Feedlot Program, for most of those years. In order to get people to do things, you just simply have to, to be able to coax them into doing things. I live in the community. My wife teaches in the community, we've earned and deserve their trust. I see no problem with working with rural landowners. It's being able to offer those folks good choices, and government doesn't always offer landowners good choices. And so that's what we have to do as a society. Is to be able to, most of the time, if you offer folks good choices, enough of them will make the right choice in order to be able to have a successful program. Renville County is number one in corn, number one in soybeans, but we're also number one in conservation easements. We have 450 perpetual conservation easements in Renville County. So that says a lot about what those folks will do if they're allowed to be able to make the right choices.
Thank you, Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned the county board and the ditch authority, so I assume there's a separate ditch authority in Renville County.
The county board is the ditch authority.
Okay.
They do have 2.5 employees that do manage the ditch system.
Mr. Chairman, the projects that I've been involved with in the past, and my background is as a real estate appraiser, so I have served as a viewer for ditch projects. I have served as an appraiser in court cases where the viewer's findings were being challenged. And in most of those projects, there's always been a berm, a spoil bank, that's been a part of the ditch project and actually has been factored in the land area that's acquired for the ditch. So at what point did some of these, and I understand that you have a lot of, I have relatively little ditch in my home county, you have a lot more, and it's probably been in place much longer.
Mm-hmm.
But at what point, who, perhaps not the original ditches, all of them had spoil bank, but some of the more recent ones have always had spoil bank allowed with them, and who allowed that to disappear?
Well, the drainage ditch law that required the 16.5-foot buffer was enacted, I believe, in 1977.
Okay.
I'm wrong about that. Almost all of Renville County ditches were dug in the 50s and 60s and 40s. So basically, that law doesn't apply to any of our drainage ditches. I think we have two drainage ditches that were dug after 1977 that does require and do have the 16.5-foot buffer.
Very good. And one final comment, Mr. Chairman. In quoting grain prices, I would go back and double-check, and I think you'll find out the vast majority of bushels sold out of Renville County were sold for less than $8 for corn and $20 for soybeans.
Yeah, yeah. But, just indicating that, the pressure on the landscape is certainly driven by the price of grain. And there's no doubt about it that we're seeing an increased pressure, especially with conservation acres being taken out of crop production and old farm sites being bulldozed down, things like that. So,
thank you both. Thanks to all the presenters on the water presentations. Very helpful. We're going to quickly move to the LCCMR confirmations. Don't know whether we should do this. A couple people come up at a time or... Okay. Welcome, Ms. Gibson and Mr. Cook. Welcome to the committee, and if you want to please briefly identify, speak to the committees briefly, then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Nancy Gibson, and I'm currently the co-chair of the LCCMR. I wanted to start out that we do have some handouts.
Okay, we will get them distributed.
And if you would like, I can give you a brief background on the LCCMR and the Environmental Trust Fund.
Why don't you do it? Two or three, we got 25 minutes and several confirmations. Why don't you do a 2-3 minute one, Ms. Gibson?
Okay, appreciate it. Thank you very much. The Environmental Trust Fund.
Handouts.
Do you have the ones I gave you? The ones I gave you?
The Environmental Trust Fund was started by a constitutional amendment in 1988 and reconfirmed in 1990 and 1998. In those constitutional amendments, it was decided that the money from the lottery that was also established in 1988, that 40% of the net proceeds would go to the Environmental Trust Fund. And if you put a dollar down for a lottery ticket, approximately 7 cents of that will go into the Environmental Trust Fund. In 1998, the constitutional amendment said that we could spend 5.5% of what is in the large endowment. So last year we spent about, if it all goes through, we'll spend about $38 million. In 2006, citizens were added to the commission. It is now called the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources. You are looking at some of the citizens for their appointment approval today, of which I am one. And we will discuss sometimes up to 400 projects will come in for funding, and then we try to narrow it down to something that fits our request for proposals. Our main goal is to protect, enhance, and restore our air, land, and water. That also includes a lot of research, includes a lot of education, a lot of the aquatic invasive species that you have been hearing about the past couple of years that we've been funding for over 20 years. So we really do try to get into a lot of research, data, some of the soil situations that you heard earlier. We just completed a total soil survey map of the state, so we really try to sort of step out of the box and try to fund some different things. So if you'd like me to start with myself, I can, or we can go
you
to...
You might as well, since you
since I've got the microphone,
yes.
Okay. So, again, my name is Nancy Gibson. I've been acting as the co-chair. This will be my fourth year, if I am confirmed. My background is in wildlife. Probably my proudest moment is being co-founder of the International Wolf Center up in Ely. I've been very active in wolf issues ever since. It has taken me around the world, and I really enjoy studying predators. And also, I have a background in raptors. I have worked with the Department of Natural Resources with their non-game program, briefly worked for the Reinvest in Minnesota program. I also have a background in media. I worked for PBS for 13 years doing wildlife stories. So I really love what we do at the LCCMR. It is like taking a PhD course every summer. We learn all about the state. I've traveled around the state. We have a wonderful state. And I'm very hopeful that you will reappoint me because I really love to contribute to our state. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Gibson? And by the way, I think you were one of those who helped make it a citizens, not just legislative, but citizens commission as well.
Yes, I will take that honor.
Mr. Cook?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Tom Cook. I've been on the LCCMR since June of 2010, so I have 1 year to go on my present term, and hopefully I'll be confirmed to complete that 1 year. I, too, would echo Nancy's comments that it is an educational experience to be on the LCCMR. You do feel like you've earned a PhD, although I never officially got a PhD, but I feel I've earned one by being on the LCCMR with a wide variety of projects that we review, listen to from some of the brightest minds in the state of Minnesota. We do a lot of good work. I feel the research that the LCCMR recommends to the legislature is invaluable to the state of Minnesota. Since I retired from my 8-to-5 job in 2009, I got involved with government. I'm also on the City Council of the City of Greenfield and serve on the Pioneer Sierra Watershed Commission. So I would ask that you please allow me to continue one more year on the LCCMR so I can continue my never-ending education. Thank you.
Thank you. It is an education, I think, for everyone involved.
Mr. Chair, in the vein of Senator Dibble, this is one of my constituents, and I'm glad to see him here today.
It's good to see you too, Senator.
So,
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I count Ms. Gibson as one of mine because she's only a block outside of my district.
Okay. Block's a block, Senator Dibble.
I can see her from my front.
Who wants to go next, Mr. Moody?
My name is Norm Moody. I've been on the LCCMR since 2009 when I retired as a Cass County Land Commissioner. It has been a real opportunity to contribute and give back. For me, it's kind of full circle. In 1969, I worked on my first wildlife project was an LCMR-funded project. That's back when we were told it was tobacco money. And if you look at my resume, you can see some of the things I've done. I hope I'm contributing. I surely do enjoy it. I have a background in forestry and wildlife and some other things that you'll see on the resume. Back when I was hired by NSP, they were looking for somebody with a degree in wildlife, a degree in forestry, and a solid background in agriculture. And one of my college professors says, you know anybody that has that? And then he chuckled, and I did enjoy working for NSP. Now that I'm retired, I spend a lot of time working on energy projects for an environmental learning center, working with biomass, and most recently with solar. And I'm just having a good time. Appreciate it. hopefully I'll be reappointed.
Mr. Moody, you mentioned the tobacco tax, the original thing. What year was that that was?
That was back in 1969. That was the Bearville Deer Research Project. And so I've seen what it does in terms of stimulating students to get involved in natural resources. That was just an exceptionally good job.
Ms. Harper-Gore.
This is indeed an honor for a Wisconsin farm girl who has lived in Minnesota, I should add quickly, for 44 years, lest I be sent back across the river. I've worked as a restoration ecologist for the Federal Highway Administration, United States Department of Transportation, for 17 years, which gave me the opportunity to work with all 50 state departments of transportation, teaching them how to protect and restore native plants to highway roadsides, as well as prevent and control invasive plants from highway rights of ways. I'm excited as a former teacher of many years ago of continuing my education, only this time about Minnesota resources and hopefully protecting them for the future of my grandsons who still live here in Minnesota.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? If not, Senator Osmick, since one of them was yours, you want to make the motion?
I so do move to recommend approval of all of the presented appointments and recommend that they go to the floor for approval.
Senator Osmick moves that, could do them in alphabetic order, Thomas Cook of Greenfield, Nancy Gibson of St. Louis Park, Bonnie Harper-Lore of Minnetonka, and Norm Moody of Hackensack be recommended to the full Senate for confirmation as members of the LCCMR, or the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources. Is there any discussion of that motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Let me say thanks to all of you for your good work on the commission, and we wish you the best.
Thank you.
And with that, I think the business of the committee is finished, and this meeting is adjourned.